given that for any individual, there's a huge range in their capacity for memory,
yeah,
of like what they what their capacity might be. But that for example, for trials in court,
mm-hmm,
that you could put someone on the stand and get an eyewitness testimony from that person without first doing any kind of vetting memory to test? See how good their memory is.
This is actually the right.
Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 320 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the captain now.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artiste.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is July 15th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity. And we'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We've got a new donation from Rob, who says, I recently got Levelhead on sale on Nintendo Switch, and I've been loving it. It deserves at least full price, so I thought I'd make it up in coffees. I've since discovered your podcast, which I'm also loving. You sound like a passionate and thoughtful team. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Very thanks, nice. Rob.
This is my favorite kind of thing in the universe is when someone is like, I love getting deals, and you know, so I got this thing on sale, but then I realized afterwards that now I feel bad because the thing is so good that it seems unfair now, you know, that I have done
this. I should have paid more.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things my wife does with her stylist is they've created this like game where she goes in and gets her haircut, and then he tries to charge her less to like show like, oh yeah, we're buddies, right? And then so that she tries to tip him more, right? And then this is now the game that they play, right? Which is it's a fun way to do that. I like it. So thanks.
It's yeah. Great. Good gestures on both sides, and people get paid and people get what they need and everything's good. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters as well who donate monthly. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right, you guys, let's talk about some stuff. Okay.
Are you mm-hmm.
prepared?
Mm-hmm.
All right. First order of business on the agenda for the day. Okay. I did not go to the eye doctor for 7 years. Well, I did. I went, but I went for other things, and my vision has just got real.
I have many questions, to be
degraded.
Honest.
Degraded.
Wait. Yeah, you went for other things. You didn't have your eyes checked.
I said, don't they check your vision every time you go? Like every time?
No.
What did they do when you were in there?
No, they'll check for like eye pressure issues, and they'll check for like I went because I got like one of those stupid floater things in my vision.
Yeah, I got one of those.
And I was like, the fuck is that?
And then they were like, oh, this is just your life now, because that's apparently how that works.
But there's a lot of different things you can go to the optometrist for, but they're not always going to check your prescription, you know, because sometimes it's just a health thing. And so but that exact thought hadn't really occurred to me. We're like, I had been there many times since, you know, 2014, whatever. And so it didn't occur to me that I might need new glasses, even though I've been to the optometrist so many mm-hmm. times. And then over the course of the pandemic, I've noticed that like my computer monitor, which is on like an arm, has just gotten closer and closer to my face. And by the end of any given like work day, my vision was like kind of like my near vision was even kind of blurry. Like I'm nearsighted. So that's supposed to be my good side. You know?
I did notice when I was over helping you put up your sound panels. Because I remember looking at your computer being like, wow, that monitor's
– it's real close.
Non-ergonomically close to where your face would probably be, you know?
Yeah. So I wanted to set up an appointment like 6 months ago. But, you know, there was, I guess, like the plague. So I've just been waiting this whole time and like inching my monitor closer to my face, blowing up my font sizes. Finally went, oh my God, I can see everything. It's amazing. First thing I did, I got home and I pushed my monitor a foot back so I could finally fucking see it. But then I got new glasses that are they're like more round. And then I thought, you know, now's the time for a new look because I got the new glasses. I think if I grow a beard, I can get sort of a bald Robin Williams from Good Will Hunting vibe going on. So I'm going to go for that. And I learned something else because I've tried to grow a beard in the past and I couldn't because it itched. Mm-hmm. Just itched. Like growing a beard kind of – there's an itchy peak. There's a stage where it – But the thing is, it's not that itchy.
No.
But I wasn't able to handle it because it was slightly distracting. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm on Ritalin, I can grow a beard. Whoa. Because it itches a little bit, but I can just not think about it, you know? So, yeah, little known fact that actually, like, Ritalin grows facial hair. You know that? Did you know that?
I think it's funny because you have the thickest possible beard situation, mm-hmm. as far as how your hair on your face, like, is constructed, but you've never actually, mm-hmm. you've never been the one to take the plunge. Now it's time.
I've never grown it because of brain.
Yeah.
But now, because of drugs, I am growing it.
Good.
I'm very excited. Yeah,
imagine if you did the whole suite of things, you know, so you lotion your face, you oil your beard, you take Ritalin or Adderall or whatever.
Well, yeah, the Ritalin also helps with remembering to oil and lotion.
Yeah, that helps a lot too.
So, Ritalin really is just like a great beard growing agent. So would recommend. It takes maintenance and focus to grow
this beard. Well, this is funny because really what you're saying here is that one of the symptoms of ADHD is the inability to grow a beard.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the possible symptoms, because of course it's a spectrum. Everybody's different. But just that link, you know, is kind of
– you wouldn't think it.
Yeah, you wouldn't think it.
But it kind of just dips into how, like, so many things in your life are affected by weird quirks of your brain that you wouldn't really anticipate until you look back and you're like, oh, wait, yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, it's always undo hidden. It has to somehow be revealed and then every fucking time. In retrospect, you're like, well, I mean – duh.
Obviously.
Yeah.
It's like I used to in traveling, if we have to hop in the car and like go somewhere, then instead of leaving, you know, like whatever someone has like a checkout time, it's like late. Like, why would you ever check out late at a place? I don't understand. Because like, I just need to get up and go. Like, we're leaving. It's moment to wake up to go, whether it's to the airport, to hop in the road trip, like, or in the car to finish a road trip. My wife's family does it literally the opposite. We're like, they sort of milk that final day literally as much as possible, right? Because which actually makes sense when you think about it, because, you know, especially
because you don't really want to sit in an airport, but
yeah,
but then you might miss your flight though.
But then you just think about it all the time. And so, yeah, it's been the same for me with like the road trip stuff, where I was stunned at how much more fun it was to actually do things like road trip or even travel, because I wasn't needing to just get up and sprint out of the building, you know, at basically 12:01, the day of the exit, which has been big.
Yeah, that was something I think the term is like ADHD paralysis that people use to describe this feeling of knowing that you have an event coming that has somewhat unknown contours. So, like, I feel this way if I have a doctor's appointment at a place I haven't been before, mm-hmm. or something. You're like,
where am I going to park? How do I get in there? What if I get lost?
Right. Yeah. So there are several questions about timing, when to go, how long it'll take you to find the office. You know, like, there's just a bunch of unknowns ahead of you. And because of that, it takes up an outsized amount of space in your brain. And then it becomes just really hard to do pretty much anything mm-hmm. until that thing is done.
This is why I always try to schedule things for the earliest possible time in the morning.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And so this is like what you're describing, Sam, which is like travel is exactly that. It's going to a series of sort of chaotic events, right? Because like you got to get to the airport and like travel and do all these things, but that are on strict timetables, which is like the ADHD nightmare.
Strict for you, but not for them, right? Because like flight could get delayed. It could get canceled. You could get there. Now you're just stuck there because you finally got there and they were like, fuck you, buddy. And now you're just in some random place. And now what do you do? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I always go to my preference is to go to the airport like 2 hours before the flight.
Yep. Same.
Have 2 hour layovers at least anytime I have a layover, because I would rather go through all the steps of getting to the gate, even though it takes 5 minutes, you know, get to the gate and then just chill there and read a book or something. But now I've all the questions are answered.
Yep. You can actually relax once you've gotten to that seat. But until then,
every single – like I just exclusively use direct flights unless there's like – and this is just no way, because every additional stop – adds like it 5x's the
it ratchets all the, up the anxiety
of like, oh no, because now
you just gotta do it again,
right? You just gotta do it again because like you don't know if they're gonna cancel it. You don't know if your flight's gonna get delayed on the first leg, you know, you don't know if weather's gonna hit once you get somewhere, you know. It's like, so all of a sudden, like, every little additional piece becomes
– And again, it's weird because you don't really care about those things. It's just that your brain won't quit making you think about them.
Yeah. Well, because now I'm trying to figure out like – because now I'm trying to plan ahead. I'm like, okay, well, what will happen? What am I going to do you know, in those scenarios so I can get out ahead of it and know, you know, all the different options?
Yeah, it's the worst. But yeah, so anyways, you know, drugs help and then you can grow a beard and you can have different vacation styles. It's crazy. It's great.
Yeah, actually, I'm wondering, now that you say this, I have noticed, but because I don't have a very good memory. Actually, I don't know if we talked about this in the podcast, but like, while we're talking about brain stuff, there's a thing that's called, what's called, it's called like something deficient autobiographical memory, severely deficient autobiographical memory. Mm-hmm. Did I tell you guys about this even? It was something I stumbled across a little fairly recently.
I don't know if we've talked about it on the podcast.
I don't think we have, but so this is, cause this is, so like we talked about before, like anytime we learn about things like ADHD and we're like, oh no, oh, we have this, right? Or in my case, aphantasia, where you can't picture things in your mind. You're like, oh, this is like, when you learn about those things as the person who is, who has it, right? You're also learning that the opposite exists for the first time, right?
Correct, right.
And so, because you just have your experience and that's what you know, and you're not over here thinking like, oh no, other people can picture things in their brains and I can't, or that's not happening. The idea of somebody, the idea of somebody literally picturing something in your brain hasn't occurred to you as a fact that exists in the world, right? And of course, you can't imagine it in the same way that you can't imagine the opposite if you can, right? So, so it's one of the things that I always thought that aspect was why I couldn't remember stuff. Because I was like, you know, memories are really tied for people who can see. It's really tied to all the visual components that you've kind of, you know, stored and adapted over time in your memory as you look back and stuff.
It's also one of the tricks for memories that one of the best ways to do memory encoding is to do it through multiple sensory channels. So it's not just like a written thing, but it's also imagining the picture to associate with the thing. It lays down a thicker track in the mind, basically. So yeah, if you got no images, then you don't have thicker tracks by default. So imagine
And the mind goes further, actually, is that I don't see stuff, but I also like I can't recapture like a smell or a sound or anything either. So there's, I have like basically no sense memory. But there's this thing called that's sort of like aphantasia, fairly recently discovered and not very well studied. But they called it severely deficient autobiographical memory. And so I learned something new that I didn't know about other people, which was how autobiographical like about yourself, right? How your life history works in your brain, right? Which is that as you experience something, it kind of goes into your brain. It's like, this is me telling you my understanding of it, given that I don't experience it, right? But so as you experience a thing and as you get further removed in time from that, right? Your memory of it goes from very experiential, where like if you're reflecting back, you're going to be perceiving that in a first person kind of a view, right?
Right.
So it's all kind of fuzzy and it's not exactly like a camera or whatever. Again, I assume. So as time goes on, it's almost like the camera zooms out, right? And it goes from a first person view into a third person view, right? As it starts to move from an experience that you're re-experiencing into a story about a thing
about
that
you.
Right. And as you get that distance, that's also like everything kind of gets dampened and softened and all this stuff, right? So I don't have either of those two things, which is interesting. But the severely deficient part comes from apparently people who don't have that first step, where they don't have the first person like experiential aspect of it. Again, this is – there's no – it's really hard to study brains, right? So how people like think and stuff. So the idea is that – people who basically just like literally can't remember stuff, like it's just gone from their past and most of their past effectively doesn't exist in their brains, they didn't have that first step because that's the step that really – because it's so experiential and especially if you revisit it, that's the stuff that starts to turn into the story that you tell yourself, right?
Yeah, so it does all the encoding for you. I mean that's such a –
it does all the encoding. It fills in all the blanks. And this is also why memories are at least partially false always, right? Is because it's your brain – retelling a story that through like experiencing it and re-experiencing it, but each time it's an echo of itself, you know, and people with this thing, since they don't have that first step, they don't have experiential memory, then they just forget because the system that encodes it and embeds it just isn't there. Right.
How prevalent is that, I wonder? Because I mean,
I don't know.
Something that people always talk about is just how memory is statistically unreliable, right?
Yeah.
But there are people who do have incredibly good memories that are fairly reliable. And then there are people who have almost no memory right? Mm-hmm. Who
can't. Plus, the thing is, all this stuff yesterday. All this stuff is a spectrum, right? And there are, of course, there are like organic brain disorders that, like in memory centers and stuff, that can cause various things. And there's whatever I've got going on, and people like that. Like, there's so that, just like with any way that your brain does a thing, it's always on a spectrum of some sort, right?
Yeah.
And so it's, but the first step when you're trying to then study something like this is realizing that there's a difference, right? First realizing there's a dimension that you can like measure and talk about and reason about that exists. Because like if you take a moment to think like, how do I remember things? As in like, what does that look like? Hmm. What happens when I remember something? What happens when I'm converting an experience into a memory, right? You don't have a fucking idea. You've never sat down and tried to do that before and like think through
what that does, right?
It's just something that's been happening. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you have to realize that that's a thing that's been happening because it's invisible to you, right? And then be like, oh, how does this work? And then try to figure that out. And now you're trying to observe yourself, right? Make that happen, which now you're changing the outcome because you're observing yourself do it. So then you're like, okay, I'll only go try to observe other people, except you can't see in there. You don't know what's going on.
So now you start. So you have to ask them to observe themselves and tell you. Right. But now that's wrong too.
Yeah, because now the questions that you ask are informed by your own experience that you tried to apply, right? And this is also why most of our understanding of all ways that brains work are based on the very bad approximation that the person who realized we should go look at that had, right? Because every single question from then on out was biased into that domain of that person's idea of what the thing was, right?
Okay, you know what's wild about this though is that given that for any individual, there's a huge range in their capacity for memory,
yeah,
of like what their capacity might be. But that for example, for trials in court, mm-hmm, that you could put someone on the stand and get an eyewitness testimony from that person. Without first doing any kind of vetting memory to test. See how good their memory is.
This is actually the right. Yeah. Do you guys remember? I guess it would have been 2 Decembers ago. I had to go to jury duty.
Oh yeah,
right. And so they actually wanted to put me on a grand jury, which is like, and so they sent me the info for that, and they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna need you for like 3 to 6 months, 3 days a week, and I was like, no, I can't do this. What do you mean? Like, and they're like, no, we'll pay you $15 a day though. So like, you know, so just in case people don't know how the American system works for jury duty, they're like, cause if you don't attend, then they throw you in jail. Right. So now imagine being a person who doesn't have the flexibility I do, and you don't have, you're like working a minimum wage job. The person will fire you if you leave. And you're like, I have to do this or go to jail. And they're like, okay, well now you're fired. And I guess you'll just have to make $15 a day for the next three. Anyway, that's an aside. But it's
and then you're like, maybe aggravated. I will go to jail because I have no other options now.
Yeah, that might be the outcome, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, great.
Good job, America.
So, but I wrote a note in and I was like, I literally can't because I run a very small company and I can't just be gone. I just can't just be gone for 6 months. That doesn't make any sense. So then they put me on a regular thing, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just an aside because I think all this stuff is so interesting and weird. So when we went through, they do that whole, the voir dire process, mm-hmm, you know, where both sides got their lawyers and their lawyers are like trying to stack the jury. That's their, I mean, that they state that that's not their goal. They have to say that that's not what they're doing, but why are we lying to ourselves? Yeah. I don't understand. Yeah.
So both sides are stacking against each other, which is supposed to make it balanced.
Yeah. Cause you can like throw out each other's picks and there's a whole process. So there's like, I don't know, 60 of us or 80 of us or something like that. There's a whole bunch of us in this room for the selection process. And they just go through and like each lawyer just has a set of questions. So they start at the top, ask, and they just go down the line. I just get an answer from everybody, right? So it's just the slowest, most horrible process. But one of those questions was about how we felt about different kinds of evidence, right? And then it came to me and I answered, which is like, I trust literally no evidence, but in particular – eyewitness testimony, because that's apparently what this case hinged upon, you know. And I wasn't doing this because I wanted to get out of jury duty, although I didn't, you know, I mean, I did. But
just being honest.
I was just because they were like, yeah, of course, because too, they're like, if you're not honest, we throw you in jail. So I was like, okay, well, here's the truth then. Like, I'm not going to believe a goddamn word anybody says in this whole process. So, but yeah, that's apparently that case, which was a murder case, I discovered later. Mm-hmm. Its only evidence was eyewitness testimony. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the number one reason people are incarcerated wrongly? Eyewitness testimony.
Incorrect eyewitness testimony. Yeah. Anyway. Memories are bad. Memories are bad.
Really bad. And like, yeah, and we all trust them so much. Yeah, well, yeah, it's a spectrum, right? And I think the problem is that we're all taught our whole lives to trust our memory, right? And so I think it would be one thing if it was bad and everybody kind of understood that, because then you can work around that. You can kind of figure out ways to find the truth in the memory and all this stuff, right? And then you can use it, because now it's just a piece of sort of contaminated evidence. And you can kind of figure out, like, where's the contaminated part? And you could take a bunch of eyewitness testimonies and kind of figure out what it means. And, like, if you know why they end up being wrong and what aspects they turn wrong, you know? And there's a whole – the people know this already. There's a whole science of this, mm-hmm. right? So you could use that. But instead, they're just like, what did you just see?
First oh, okay. They saw it.
Yeah, I believe that now. And that's the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Interesting. All right. Now, I want to talk about Adam's first week as CEO.
Yes. New captain of the ship.
Kind of speaking of – you know, we're talking about memory, this idea of – you've kind of always been doing things a certain way, and that's just kind of how you've been doing them. And now you've got to become a third-party observer in the thing mm-hmm. and figure out what's actually going on, which is exactly what Adam's been doing this past week.
Yep.
And how's that been going?
It's – well, I've only just begun, because the first – because it's all about – I don't know. I think it's a really interesting puzzle. Basically, I'm not coming in as an outsider, but in a way it feels like that. You know, where
well, you're trying to remove yourself from the
yeah, I'm trying to like
become a
right
observer,
right? And, yeah. But because we shared so much responsibility, including like management of all of our people, management of projects, all this kind of stuff, then this core question to me that I'm mostly focusing on of visibility, which is just what's going on, you know, is that we, I mean, all of us knew that none of us knew what was going on, like the full picture, you know, but I also didn't really work that hard to try to figure that out previously, because I was like, whatever, stuff's getting taken care of. Who cares, you know?
And you knew what was going on in your domain.
Yeah. And anytime I had like something where I was like, oh yeah, what about this thing? And then I would just make sure I surfaced that. And then somebody would be like, oh yes, I am taking care of that. Or oh no, I'm not. Let's figure that out. Right. Mm-hmm. So that was a chaotic process that we were all doing that, you know, kind of worked, but it did mean that none of us actually knew what was going on. And so that's this first part of this process. And it's really interesting going from knowing conceptually that I don't really know what's going on, right? To then trying to start figuring out what's going on and seeing just how true that was that I didn't know, mm-hmm. you know? And also going from this idea of things having been organically, iteratively developed, you know, collaboratively, right? And with actually not really a lot of because it's always like when you're doing iteration, you're always like iterating on the past thing, right? So there – every once in a while in our journey, we've stepped back more significantly and like redesigned a big thing about how the studio works. But most of it's been very focused. It's been like, how do we manage like work very specifically, or it's been stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
But not just the whole thing. And so trying to even figure out like what does the whole thing even mean? You know, like what are all the components of our business, a business in general, but our business? You know, what does it mean?
What are the divisions? What is work and how does it move between
and who's doing – yeah, exactly. Who's doing what and how do we know? And
how do
why
they
are they
know
doing those
what
things?
To do?
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually – so I've been like – I've basically been trying to figure out that. So I'll try to write up some stuff about it as I go, as I kind of get – as I get past the first part and actually start turning things that I've realized I need to do into things that I'm doing, you know. I'm going to try to start making that stuff public in some way, because I think it's really interesting. But the first part of this has basically just been like just brain dumping, being like, what are all the things that I think I need to be thinking about? It's not even necessarily that I want to change or that I'm worried about. It's just I'm trying to figure out what all the things are, you know. And even something like the three of us are simultaneously the shareholders and the board and employees of the company, right? And yep. So in a bigger company, all three of those types of entities have completely different goals and incentives, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but we've never even thought about like trying to separate those concerns, at least conceptually, and ask like, are we acting right now in our role as shareholders or as employees, right? And that kind of stuff. And so anyway, the whole thing has been very just interesting to try to figure out how to puzzle through this. So I've been having a good time. I've been having a time. So it's a little bit anxiety inducing, just a little bit, but mostly because at the moment there are so many threads that I know are – because I've like picked apart a knot, right? And like the loose ends are hanging everywhere. There's still a big knot there and I haven't done anything with it yet. I'm just like pulling the threads out.
Sort of the first part where you do all the surveying and tallying to figure out what's actually important to do.
Yeah.
And as you continue through that process, at some point you're like, shit, there's just
– yeah.
there's here's just all these things, but you haven't actually pared it down yet. And that's where the anxiety starts to go away, I think, which would be.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think in terms of like, if someone out there is, you know, going through something like this, or, you know, starting a business and want to, or has a business and we want to like kind of revisit it. It's the thing that's been the biggest struggle is as I keep on thinking of things and trying to find, it's basically finding a way to organize this, right? Organize all mm-hmm. the things that I want to be thinking about and need to make sure I don't forget. And that's because that consists of investigations into things. It consists of projects I want to do. It consists of a million different things, right? And they don't have an obvious relationship to each other because they have a bunch of different goals and categories, you know? And so finding ways to kind of take this enormous amount of chaos up front and organize it just enough that it doesn't get lost, and then also prioritize it, because mm-hmm. all those things have to get, you know, all these things have to be found out and dealt with, right? And there are things that I want to do because it feels urgent and important, right? But if I don't do this other thing for, I mean, it's just like any kind of work, right? If I don't do this other thing first, then yeah, I could do that, but I'm probably gonna have to rework it later anyway, right? And yep. and so it's stuff like, I realized the first thing I need to do is just figure out, how do we communicate with each other? Which, you know, seems like dumb and obvious, right? Except that also grew organically. We didn't design it, right? And I already like just discovered all the useful powers of Google Groups that I didn't know about before, which has already fundamentally changed how I can surface information about what I'm doing to the rest of the team and stuff. Because I've got the chance to sit down and be like, how do I know that if I send a piece of information somewhere that the other person definitely gets it and definitely acts on it, right? And how do I know that if I've now done this, that the record of that having happened is now visible to the right people, right?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm particularly excited about all of this, because I feel like this is the right time, because thinking about the way that we conceived of our work and what it meant to run a business and stuff like that, you know, 5 years ago or something, mm-hmm. If we had picked one of us to be the CEO, the person just whose only job was just make sure the company runs smoothly and is able to capitalize on opportunities and manage its resources well and grow and whatever, we wouldn't have had stuff like, you know, our DevOps principles, right? And all this experience with what it means to hire and train and grow and develop tech and stuff like that. And I think it's telling that, you know, what you're talking about, Adam, is that your first move is visibility, mm-hmm. right? Which is the first principle of DevOps.
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely taking a DevOps approach to
it. Which is don't even think about the problems you're trying to solve because you don't know.
I don't know what's here yet.
Yeah. Right. You can't, if you can't see stuff,
exactly,
you can't make decisions. So the only first move is to just make things visible and then just look at it.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that with this like communication channel thing, it's like, okay, just, it's looking around, figuring out how do people find out about stuff and tell each other about stuff. Right. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, and this is true for any R&D phase of anything, right? Where you might already know some things that you want to do. But when you don't have the full picture yet, when you don't have all the visibility you need, then you have to kind of somehow put that aside, right? And be like, I'm going to do this thing that isn't me making a thing happen, because we talk about this a lot with the idea of productivity, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning you produce a thing. Because understanding something is a prereq to then, you know, doing a thing, right? Or at least doing it reasonably well. But that part always feels like, that's not what you're supposed to be doing, you know? And so especially when you can see the effects of the stuff that you know are problems, right? And so like in our case, our daily standups don't quite fit well with how we ended up changing things once we moved to Favreau. It doesn't quite work. So it's a little janky, but it still accomplishes the goal, right? And so it's not doing any damage and it's not taking a lot of time. So I'm looking at that and I'm like, I'm going to solve this later, right? But now every morning I have to run it and be like, this is kind of a janky experience, right? And so trying to figure out how to get these things all lined up properly is, and of course there's no right way.
It's going
to
take time.
So, yeah. It just takes time. So that's been fun. It's been interesting.
Well, I do want to say one of the other side effects of this has been, because Adam's actually taken everything off of my plate now at this point.
I just told Sam to loop me in on all open biz dev threads, and I just took his name off. Mm-hmm. So he can't even see anymore.
That's great. I get like no emails now.
Mm-hmm. I get a lot now.
And then on top of that, in terms of direct management of the team, like all this other stuff. So I'm just straight chilling over here. By that, I mean now furiously working on Crashlands 2. And this also revealed, basically being able to actually sit in the work for this long has also revealed some interesting things about the importance of this Favreau switch for us. Gene Favreau is that new tool we switched over to, which allows, it's a simple
F-A-V-R-O, because we had some people who were like, I don't know how to spell that. And now I can't find it. So
that's there it is.
Yeah.
But the reality of what the power of that simple idea that's present in this tool, which is the idea that a piece of work can be in two places at the same time.
Stuff can be two things.
Yeah, because it revealed, I think, the reason why, in particular for Seth and I, usage of things like Trello or actually any work management software up until literally Favreau has oftentimes felt actually like a downgrade in terms of the ability to produce really high quality stuff. It's definitely an upgrade in terms of the ability to like get a grip on what the hell is happening.
Yeah, the higher level project management.
Yeah, but in terms of like actually, you know, turning an idea into a really cool feature. And the reason I say this is because in the past, we've talked about this with the difference between something like Favreau, Trello, and ClickUp, is basically that when we would begin working on, say, a new item in the game. You know, it starts with an idea. You start with like sort of a rough approximation of what you want to do. We draft up some concepts, have sort of a rough version of it put into the game. And then from there, it's like you're trying to now get the thing over the finish line. But the reality is, again, it needs to be able to be highly iterative. And the issue is that with a card-based system, as you were using before, every one of those iterations causes an explosion of motion work, right? Where it's like, ooh, here's these ideas about how to do this. Those get busted out into separate sort of like cards. They get sort of, because of how the card system works in that context, you can't actually meaningfully have two people on the same card if they need to do two different things with it, because you can't move it through the workflow in different ways. And so what's become very, very apparent is this, one of these items that we have, which has been sitting there for months, just like had a brief design brief that the contents of that brief were enough to make it essentially clear that we needed to do a lot of iteration on it, which meant that every time we tried to touch it, we just couldn't, because it's like sort of the weird, again, this weird motion and waste problem. And I think it started off with just like a to-do list of like 10 different sort of things. And I'm pretty sure by this point, it's sort of the reality, again, as you explore the work, is that it ballooned out to probably like 40 actual things that needed to be done.
And legit, like, this item is a weed.
It's a fucking weed, everybody. Like, it's a plant. It doesn't.
Yeah, and you mean literally, not metaphorically. It's like literally.
Literally.
It's a weed item. It's an item in the game that is a weed.
Yeah. It's a weed. But and the thing is, I mean, it's interesting mechanically. There's a reason why we didn't work on it for so long, because it's not just – so like in the original Crashlands, most things were pretty inert, right? Like you'd see a log tree and you'd chop it and you get wood.
Then
you'd see
a squee everything was plant. Something that you harvest basically.
Yeah. Like you'd see a squee plant and you'd chop it and you get squee plant parts, and it was no different mechanically than a log tree. They both just sat there and did nothing, right? And so this weed is like it spreads over time. So like there's more of them if you don't clear them out, and they grow thistles. And if you like touch them barehanded, you get hurt. But if you chop them with tools, then they harvest properly. And like there's all kinds of interesting stuff with them, which meant that it wasn't just as simple as, you know, copy paste a log tree, swap out the sprite and change the drops, right? And so when Sam initially pitched this thing back when we were using ClickUp, I was just like, okay, well, let's just put this on the back burner.
Well, because you're looking at
it. Like, I don't see how we're going to – it's like four – it is 40 things. Like it's 40 different steps of design and iteration.
Right. Know? And each one of those requires you to basically update and build new features into a system to allow not only for this to be possible, but in the enabling of this to also enable similar amounts of complexity and other things. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just didn't. But now with Favreau, we did it in a day. Like all – the whole thing. Like all the steps.
Yeah. And it wasn't – and I think that was the thing that was fascinating about it, because I was working on some other stuff, you know, like at the same time. Seth's working on it, and then he'd check in. We'd go back and forth for a second, and then like, okay, here's the next list of things. I'd pop off and go knock out one of those that like had my name on it. He would keep on working on his side. And just – it was so – it felt closer to how it was or how it is during game jams and stuff, where it's like you're just kind of – you're working together. And there's not all this weird – almost like, I guess, bureaucracy, but just like motion around being able to work together on stuff in a real sense.
Yeah. You'd have to manage the communication channels They just
yeah.
They you just are communicating through them.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You don't have to manage the fact that you're communicating.
You manage their setup. So all the overhead is in the initial setup of which was a lot. Like the if we compare the setup differences between what we have going on in Favro versus like you know ClickUp or Trello in particular. Right? Like Trello's got nothing going on. It's just a bunch of columns, right? Mm-hmm. And then when we moved from that to Monday, there was like a big spike in how much initial design overhead there was getting it together. And then we did move to ClickUp. Another big spike, and then moving into Favro, an even bigger spike because everything is so fundamentally different. But also, all of the power comes from that weird concept of being able to really centralize mm-hmm. stuff on a card. But to do that and to make sure stuff doesn't fall through the cracks requires just an ungodly number of tables and automations and visibility tweaks to make sure that the right people see the right stuff at the right time, you know. And so you end up with this really elaborate contraption. But once it's there, though,
it's actually not complicated to interact with. That's the wild thing. Because like, I would finish a piece of this.
All the complexity is hidden in the system.
Yeah. So if I finished a piece of this thing and I saw, because I can see that it's in Seth's done pile. And so I'll just be like, no, it's not. And I'll put it back in his inbox. Right. And he could do the same thing on my side. So it's like, it's
still done on your end.
Yeah. It's so easy to do all this.
Yeah. Sam did his part.
Yeah.
Crush those bugs.
I don't know. I think it's been really good, even just the last couple of days with having Adam at the helm, having the Favro systems all fully set up and getting to actually do direct feature development sort of with Seth in sync. So I'm really, really excited to see what kind of happens next couple of weeks here. I think it's going to be a rocket fuel sort of a situation for us.
Agreed. So it's something we needed. Mm-hmm. All right, you guys, you ready for some questions?
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. The highest upvote question comes from Tim Conceivable, who says, where in the Bscotch universe did Narwhal Online take place? Was that Wonope or another planet? I hope to see a lot of narwhals in Crashlands too.
I actually do remember the lore on this. It's not canon. So as long as I preface it with that, then we can just get right into it. So it's not canon.
Yeah.
But what? So the end of Crashlands, right? End of Crashlands. We send the packages through a portal, right? The idea we had then kicking around, which again, not canon, was that there was this kind of alien infestation being called a Chikroob. They're like grubby little guys, right? These are the enemies you fight in Narwhal Online. So the Polari, the Narwhal people, right? You saw them in Crashlands, right? They live in the tundra. So the idea at the time was that portal was like, you know, whenever we did some other next game that was like in the same universe, which just didn't quite happen that way, right? But the idea was going to be that like that we might update that final cutscene, right, where you would then see something. You'd see its eye.
Something slips through.
Something comes out, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that the Chikroob are this like old enemy, right? And Narwhal Online is actually in the pack, because there's some mentions of like wars
historical.
And stuff, right? It's a archive. Historical market, right? So there's an old underground basically battle because the Chikroob are underground, right? And they had infested Wonope. Like they dig tunnels, right? And so the various factions of Wonope had come together to purge this infestation, right? And of course led by the Polari because of their dope narwhal horns, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Narwhal Online takes place. And that past war.
The first invasion,
The first invasion, right. Where the outcome would have been had it not been designed as first a jam game, but then second as a as a game where it was meant to be a game that like you just got to keep on going, you know? So it was like it was an endless war, basically. Which is, you know, historically presumably what it felt like in this non-canon story that I just described. That is not canon.
I mean, I think it kind of is canon, isn't it? I mean, this was the first time we saw the Polari. They were fighting the Chikroob, which then the Polari and the Chikroob appeared in Crashlands, or at least the references to the Chikroob, right? Because that was Hugo's plan was basically he believed that he could mind control swarms of Chikroob and sort of use them to subvert the planet.
I don't remember how much of that actually ended up in the Crashlands story.
I don't think any explicit. I think it was explicit that there was a huge war that everybody had fought in together, and that the Polari had sacrificed a bunch to defeat the Chikroob. They were mentioned by name, But at that point, we had actually no idea what we were. Like, I literally just sort of like slapped the keyboard to get in the rest state.
Like, yeah, you do the classic sci-fi thing of throwing an apostrophe in there, you know?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's very spooky. If it's like an alien, they've got to use a lot of apostrophes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I was thinking about it, I was like, okay, I was like, let's just take two things that if you put them together would make some really weird things. And I was like, chickens and grubs. And so literally – you just smash it together and put an apostrophe in there, right?
Yep, and there you have it.
Which is why they're basically worms with beaks.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
100%. Which are creepy and gross, turns out. Worked out great.
It worked out great.
Yeah, actually, our first post – I don't even remember if we ever talked about it publicly, but our first post-Crashlands game that we started and then abandoned because we just couldn't figure it out was basically like – it was basically Narwhal Online, right? Yeah. It was like – taking that from the jam game conception into the actual game. I can't remember what we called it now, but we had the domain name and everything. We were ready to go, you know, but we didn't quite have our shit figured out to pull it off at that time.
Well, it was actually going to be a lot more involved than that, but I think we were calling it Whippersnappers.
Whippersnappers is different.
That
was
Home Slice.
Home Slice turned into Whippersnappers.
Yeah, Home Slice was the code name.
And then we switched over to Scuffle Buddies. And I think between those two is actually when we revisited that online concept. Mm, okay. Yeah. But I think we got like 2 or 3 weeks into that one and then sort of spun it out and we're like,
Yeah, we didn't get really far into it. We got far enough to kind of start building conceptually what it was going to be. And it was just going to be really big, which was really the kind of the core of all of our difficulties at that time.
Yeah, that was 2017. We started and then abandoned three whole games that year.
Or 2016, actually. Right. Yeah. Between 2016 and 2017, because it was right after Crashlands launch in January 2016.
Well, we didn't start any new games until 2017.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
2016 2016 was basically controller support for Crashlands.
Yeah, right. It was a lost year, basically.
That was like 4 months of work just into that. And then learning how to, you know, hire and expand the studio and stuff. We all moved that year too. Like it was a big transition year, but
yeah.
All right, next question. We have a couple of questions. They're kind of related. So first one's from Chelosis, who says, at work, if I have tasks that either seem like they will be difficult or seem like they will be boring, I have a very hard time focusing on them, and it takes me much longer than it should. Do y'all ever need to use focus techniques like Pomodoro?
I find that time boxing, Pomodoro stuff, setting timers, all of those are always useful. To be honest with you, like in the same sort of way, like if I'm ever like more sleepy during a day or whatever else, and then I just say like, okay, I'm gonna set this timer for 25 minutes and like get a move on. I still find it super useful. So I guess the short answer is yes, but I also I try to do more upfront work with the work that I'm clearly trying to avoid to figure out why that's the case and to see if I can make it interesting. Right. So a big part of what I think used to be my challenge on some of the art stuff is, and you get sort of a prompt and it's like, oh yeah, we need like a, I don't know, like a weird plant or something to go in here. Right. And previously, you know, that was sort of like the directive. And then when you're running up against that, you actually don't have much. It seems like you have everything you need to grab onto, but you actually don't. And so the first thing I do now is I literally write like a little dumb blurb, almost like especially if it's like an item or something like that in Crashlands. But even if we're doing a biz dev case or whatever else, I always write either like a goal or like a high level story about this thing, whether it's why it's important or some of the various aspects of it. And it's literally like maybe 2 minutes of just jamming on a keyboard, being like, you know, on the item side, it'd be like, here's kind of where this thing sits in the ecosystem. Here's kind of how to think about it, what it does. On things that you would generally consider more boring, it's actually the same, but it's framed as a goal. So I literally have my notepad up and I type goal, colon, and then just write for like a minute or so, like do this.
This is literally how I start every single new thing I do, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
How big it is, how small it is, how bored I am about it. It's just always the first thing is, what am I trying to do?
Yeah. And for whatever reason, like once you do that, at least for me, like I've had to rely a lot less on the timers and things like that. Cause I think what those are really doing for you is forcing you to get far enough into the work that you find those toeholds where like it becomes more apparent why it's an important or good, useful thing to do or whatever else. Right.
I would say it's actually not about getting farther into the work. This reminds me of just the psychological concept of flow states, right? Which is that if something is is boring, meaning it's like it's not challenging, it's not interesting. In other words, the challenge doesn't match your skill level, right? Then it's very hard for you to sort of focus in on it, right? And similarly, if the thing is too hard for your skill level, then you also can't focus in on it because you just keep running into blocks.
Yeah, right? You don't know how to start.
Yeah, and this is a common game design problem, right? Like we want our players to be in a flow state, and we try to design challenges for our players that match their current level of skill and knowledge and stuff like that, so that they can just sort of like get into a zen mode and just have a great time.
Trying to remind them that they're playing a game, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like what you're talking about is actually not necessarily getting into the work, but actually redesigning the work. So if you see the work and it's like, wow, this is boring and I have no interest in doing it, then instead of doing it, what you do is you go in and you change what it means to do the work, such that it's no longer boring. Like you, by reframing the goals, you're kind of like ratcheting the challenge up in a new way, mm-hmm. to match what your skill is. And similarly, if something is too hard, then when you're digging into it in those early research stages, you are having to answer the questions about why does this seem so hard and how do I make it easier?
Right? Yeah, then your first goal is basically getting a toehold on it, you know, somehow.
Right. Yeah, if you find yourself avoiding the work, then continue avoiding the work, like of doing the work, and instead just do some work to redesign and rebuild the approach to the work.
And this even goes down to like, I mean, because we've had to do all sorts of, you know, zany stuff as far as just straight up copy pasting a bunch of things around, or, you know, managing a bunch of crap in Excel. And it's like, if each time you're doing one of those things, you know, aside from just trying to get yourself to do it, if you can step back and just ask the question, like, how could I do this so that it would be like, again, not interesting, but just ask the question, like, how could I do this so that it's just done more effectively? It doesn't suck as much for me.
And this is why I love regular expressions, because
regex.
Yeah, regex. Because all the things that Sam just described, like, just regex, mm-hmm. top to bottom. Which there's no point getting into, and because it's not a technical podcast, but but it's one of those valuable things that like every single programmer has seen before, you know, like you've seen it, and then you've almost every single one also ran away screaming, right? Because it's not friendly. It's not friendly, but it is like every time I get to deploy that skill set, I am so fucking glad that I took the time to really figure that out, because it's just so much better.
It converts problems that are very uninteresting into very interesting.
Into a puzzle. Like, yeah. And actually, so I want to get it. I don't know if the three of us have talked about this outside of the podcast either, but my wife had found this sort of ADHD thinking framework about how to identify like why is a thing hard to focus on, right? And this is thinking about in the context of ADHD, but like everybody else has the same struggles, just not as debilitatingly, right? So presumably this is useful to everybody, mm-hmm. Which is – so the abbreviation is ICNU, which is not terribly easy, fun to say, but ICNU, right? Which is let's make sure I got it over here. I was just looking at it. Okay, yeah, here we go. So it's for you to be able to focus on a thing and like do it, right? It needs to be one of these four things: interesting, challenging, novel, or urgent. Novel meaning new. Mm-hmm. Novel or urgent, right? So ICNU. So, and I do think this is true of everybody. It's just if you have ADHD, you literally can't unless it's one of those things. So what does time boxing do? Makes it urgent.
It's urgent.
Yep. What does procrastination do?
Also makes it urgent.
Right? and challenging.
It's the same reason why getting curious about these boring problems to mm-hmm. ask them those questions is what makes them novel, and oftentimes even more challenging than they would be in a way that would make you too bored to even address it, right?
Yeah. So like, I mean, as an example for me trying to take over the business stuff, right? Like I'm basically starting from first principles. I'm treating this as a academic / philosophical / practical problem, right? And so the root of it is, what is a business? You know what I mean? Like, what is this? What
treat
is this
it as
for?
A novel problem.
Who would you
treat
say
as, treat it as a novelty? But actually, that's my big project coming up soon for everybody to answer is exactly what would you say you do here?
We're gonna have a meeting with the Bobs.
Yeah, exactly.
Be like, honestly, I roll in. I use the back door. Coming 15 minutes. Yeah, I heard this bit just yesterday. It's hilarious. It's coming like 15 minutes late, so no one could see me. And then I just space out for about an hour. Looks like I'm working. I'm not doing anything.
I'm not doing anything.
It's killer.
Yeah, honestly, if you haven't seen the movie Office Space, I mean, because it's like, I mean, this movie is dated. It's like 22, 23 years old now.
But yeah, how well does it hold up in terms of, you know, social progressivism?
I think okay.
Does it hold up okay?
Because a big part of
most things from that time don't.
Most things from that time have problematic angles that they didn't need to have on certain things.
I mean, so much of
the core.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say, you know, the core idea of Office Space is to sort of it's to deflate the bubble that we live in and just point out how people really live their lives and mm-hmm. and how absurd so many of the things we do are.
And it's alive and real, even with remote work. Like I do have a friend, I guess, especially with remote work, actually, because I think the absurdity of it becomes even more apparent once people are in their own homes.
Yeah,
doing
yeah.
some of this goofy shit. But I do have a friend. Who bought a mouse wiggler because their company has one of those dumb
– they're tracking that shit.
You can't go idle. If you're idle for 5 minutes, then they harass you about it. And so she bought a mouse wiggler.
Yeah, and I was just seeing how fucked up these rules and dumb and pointless and missing the mark, right? Because these things aren't achieving what people think they're achieving, right?
No.
And I heard a story about – because all the, you know, all these kids had to do school from home, right, for the past year or whatever. And hearing stories about that too, because like we all remember how fucking stupid the rules at school are and how just universally idiotic the whole approach is to like
– going to the
bathroom. They're basically trying to prepare you for the idiocy of working as an adult, right? So yeah, it's like, fair, oh, can I have permission to use my – right, they are, right? They were on target. But it's like, can I have permission to expel waste from my body somewhere else? Instead of right here, right? That's one of the things you have to ask. You have to ask somebody permission to do that. Isn't that insane? But yeah, so I saw a thing where, a parent was complaining because the teacher for this class, this virtual class, was really pissed off at this kid who was eating, you know, during class. And not like making noise eating or like being gross, they were eating, you know. And they were in their own house, you know, they were sitting on their couch, mm-hmm. having a snack,
participating
in the class. But they were eating though. And that same parent then went through like the rule list of what their kids were supposed to do and not do. You know, and it was like, they can't be like laying in their bed, like watching this. They can't be like lounging on the couch. They have to be sitting, you know, upright, like doing nothing else. They can't be drinking anything, you know, whatever. It's like this list of things. It's like,
I think this just goes to show, why? Right? Because back when we were in school, those rules were there, of course, mm-hmm. for us. You know, you can't have a water bottle because mm-hmm. there might be vodka in it. Yep. as if nobody would, you know, smell that. Really, all those rules existed to just create a sense of rigidity to everything. The rules mm-hmm. themselves were pointless, right? Of like, you can't. Chew gum in class. You can't have a snack. You can't drink. If you're seen in the hallway, you need to display your hall pass to prove that you have permission to not be in a classroom at this exact moment, right?
Well, I guess it's all about finding, and it's like it's all about finding docility and then making it deeper.
It's creating obedience.
It's creating culture, obedience, right? Yeah, correct. Because then all the kids who don't do it, then they get kicked out of the system. Right,
right, right. So you create this, you create this sort of this hierarchical authority, which is that these are the rules, and whatever we say, no matter how weird it is, you mm-hmm. have to do it, or you will be punished. Right, and it's just to continuously reinforce that with every single interaction you have with the teachers and the principal and stuff. And they like because I think the fact that those rules still apply, even when the context is completely different, right?
Which
is
like in your own home.
Can I pee? In my own house. Mm-hmm. Can I sit on my couch or are you going to make me sit on the dining room chair? Right. And it's like, they're going to try to extend that authority because it's not about the consequence of the rules. It's just about establishing authority. Mm-hmm. Right. If you haven't seen Office Space, it's worth it's a so watch. Mm-hmm. It's old enough now that I think you could be graduating from college and it would have come out before you were born, probably.
mm-hmm. So, that's probably true. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net. We have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.